Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. At the end of the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question, you may press star, then one. This conference is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Lita Dennison. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you so much. I am really excited to have you here for, I think, what will be my final data science seminar series here at the National Science Foundation. It has been an absolute pleasure chairing this series. If you have been able to attend a few of these in the past, we have had some very outstanding speakers and incredibly influential change makers in the field of data science that we have hosted here in this room. And it has been my pleasure to be a part of this program, and I think we are extending that line of excellent speakers and thought leaders with today's speaker, Dr. Grossman from the University of Chicago. Our colleague here at National Science Foundation, Dr. Chaitin Baru, has offered to introduce our speaker, and I want to thank you so much for coming out to our series. I know it will continue. I'm not quite sure who will be chairing it next, but I am sure we will continue with a string of wonderful speakers in the future. Thank you again.
All right. Thank you, Lita. Actually, I'm going to request the audience to give a little applause for our AAAS fellows. Some are not here, but you can convey the applause to them. The Data Science Seminar Series was started at the beginning of this year by our enthusiastic batch of Big Data AAAS fellows. And I think, as Lita said, and if you see on the web, we've had fantastic speakers lined up, including Bob today. And hopefully we'll continue this into the next year. So, okay, it's my great pleasure to introduce Bob Grossman. He's a faculty member at the University of Chicago, where he's the Chief Research Informatics Officer, CRIO, of the Biological Sciences Division, and Director of the Center for Data Intensive Science. He's also a Senior Fellow and Core Faculty in the Institute for Genomics and Systems Biology, and the Computation Institute, and a professor in the Department of Medicine in the section of genetic medicine. But more importantly, I've known Bob for like more than 20 years, I think, when both he and I had a little bit more black hair or color hair. Your hair is Bob. The thing I wanted to say is that I think you'll find in this talk as well is that I've characterized Bob as, you know, somebody who's always been thinking at the frontier. Ever since we've known him 20 plus years ago, some of you may or may not know the predictive modeling markup language, PMML, is something that he developed way before predictive models was a buzz term that we all use. I remember maybe 1.5 decades ago, he and I were at the same NASA tutorial session that was being given at the Goddard Space Flight Center. He was talking about data mining, and I still remember when he, in his talk, he mentioned that 80% of what you do in the real world, because Bob actually had a company that was doing real world stuff, is data cleaning. And this was, 15 years ago or so. He had seen some of those issues. Last year, we ran into each other again at the Yale Day of Data, where he was one of the speakers, and so was I. Bob also, most recently, has been on the National Academy of Sciences study for the future directions of the NSF Advanced Cyber Infrastructure, ACI, report. So the report that has recently come out and has drawn a lot of interest, Bob was on the committee for that. And finally, a lot of what he's going to talk about today, the commons idea, he has mentioned to me repeatedly, so I should mention it here, is actually the roots of it are in NSF program. So right now, if you look at all of this, it sounds like NCI, commons, and cancer genome data, et cetera, and NIH is taking a lot of credit for it, our friends Phil Bone and company. But NSF actually got this started. So he had a PIER grant in those days, because as a PI, you try to get your money whichever way you can. And I guess PIER happened to be the vehicle to do this. So I think NSF should be very proud of the stuff that you're doing today. And come on ahead, Bob. Please welcome Bob Rosa.
So it's going to be a short talk unless I can advance the slide. Oh, okay. Thank you. So you don't have to read this, but the reason I'm putting this here is the work was, you know, as you get older, all the important things are done by others. And so, this work is the work of a lot of people. And we've published a few papers in the last few months. And I'll point you the papers, and they're on the slides. But I just want to give credit to the team that worked on this. Some of you, you don't have to look at the details of this diagram, but this is sort of what drove HPC for a long time, is a so-called Branscom pyramid. And one of the things I want you to keep in mind is, you know, what is the Branscom pyramid that sort of led to leadership class high-performance computing at the top? What does that look like in the era of data, and what should it look like in the era of data? So that's the first thing I want you to think about as I talk. And then this is another thing I want you to keep in mind as I talk. This is sort of a 20, 25-year perspective on how we work with data. So for a long time, what we did with data is we downloaded it, we analyzed it, we produced reports and papers, and then we published those papers. Over the last few years, we've built cyber infrastructure to make it easier to use clouds and other infrastructure and HPC to analyze data at scale. But I want you to begin to think of where we're going to be in the next, 10 years, and how do we do the research to get there, and how can we change the way we use data. I'm going to talk about data commons. Why do we have data commons? We have data commons, and this is a term, as Chetan said, used by NIH. We have data commons for a very, very simple reason. If your NIH does not have enough money so that every researcher can have their own copy of the data. So what that means is either researchers start to publish without looking at the data, which is not what we're supposed to do in science, or else we have to create some other infrastructure, some other cyber infrastructure. So commons are one of those things we could create, because the commoditization of processors led to the commoditization of instruments, led to the explosion of data, and there's just too much data for the researchers to download the data they need, to spin up the infrastructure they need of computing and storage, to make it secure and compliant if it contains human data, and then to analyze it at scale. So we need something else. And one of the things that has emerged is what's called a commons. There's not a sort of an acceptable definition of commons out there, so I'm going to actually give one. You don't have to agree with this one, but at least this is precise enough that you could either agree or disagree, accept or change it. And so what I think of as a commons is the collocation of data, which is the most important, is the collocation of data with computing processors and storage, plus the commonly used services and applications, so that you can analyze, integrate, and share that data. And this is very important, so that you could create a resource for the research community. And what I mean by the resource is not only should humans be interoperating with it, not only should data scientists and disciplinary scientists be interoperating with it, but most importantly, there should be exposed APIs so it can be an interoperable resource in whatever else is out there, so that people can build applications and other systems, applications, as we'll see, that operate over it through the API, and systems that, and we'll use this precisely later, that peer with it. And I'll talk a little bit about that. So that's what I mean by commons. There's no generally acceptable terminology out there, but today this is what I mean. So we've been in the business of building commons for almost a decade, almost 8 to 10 years now, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about the commons we've built, and then a little bit about the technology. So we built our first commons in 2008 to 2010 for NASA, where we took one of their satellites, EO1, and put all the data that we could into a cloud, and then made it possible to operate over that cloud by Earth scientists, and then allow them to build their own applications over that cloud. And then based on that, we got some funding from the Moore Foundation. I give the Moore Foundation a lot of credit. They took a gamble on us, and then we built a general science cloud that generalized the services and architecture and improved the services and architecture of the NASA cloud. The NASA cloud we built was called the MATSU project, and they gave us a funding, and then we got some matching funding from Yahoo. This was before NSF was in the business really of supporting large-scale data science and cyber infrastructure for data. And so without that critical funding from the Moore Foundation, we wouldn't have been able to demonstrate what was required in this space. We built a general purpose science cloud, and then we got we also at that point, as Chaitin said, we got a PIRE grant that allowed us to train data scientists, build on the technology, and build partnerships to get interesting data. So I'm a very firm believer in that: bring the data together, put the services over it, and then the technology will follow, and you sort of lead with the data and follow with the technology to drive the discoveries. And we then took that same technology and made a secure and compliant version where we put human genomic data to build the BioNimbus Protected Data Cloud in 2013. And then we built what I'm going to talk a little bit about, a larger scale of that for all the data at the National Cancer Institute. And so the way I think of this is the unit of data should be all the data in the world. So if you could bring that together through an interoperating infrastructure, that changes the way you do science. And so we tried to do what we could afford with NASA. We brought all the satellite data, a few of the satellite data together, but the NCI Genomic Data Commons brings all the data from NCI-funded researchers together. And then most recently, we are building an environmental commons with the same staff for NOAA through their NOAA data partnership. So we operated a test bed for about 4 years with NSF funding to understand what the technology was. Since 2010, we've supported over 860 projects from 55 organizations over 14 countries. And at any one time, probably 200 plus of them are active. And what we do is we favor those projects that need terabytes of data and tens to hundreds of thousands of hours of compute. So we could take the, you know, this is a resource allocation project. We could take the same resource, it's a finite resource, and we could slice it so that we could support 10 times or more users, but we'd have to give them less resources. And we're interested in maximizing the discoveries from a portfolio of users, but where they tend to use large amounts of data and therefore need a significant co-measured amount of compute. And so that's our niche. And we created a not-for-profit consortium, a 501c3 consortium, to sort of make this all work, and we've been operating that since 2008. So I want to tell you a little bit about that story over the next, the rest of this talk. So I've told you a little bit about the Open Science Cloud. You know, this is our, you know, when you're a computer scientist developing software, you try to write as much software as possible. When you're in the business of building commons, you try to write as little software as possible, because any software you write, you have to run. Any software you write, you have to maintain. And so you want to get the most science done with the least software. And so it's a slightly different perspective. And so we try to use other people's software whenever possible, but we're at the scale that most other people's software doesn't work. And we try to run open source always, so that we can make this available to anyone who wants to build their own commons. So we ran initially over Eucalyptus. In the first couple years of the project, we shifted to OpenStack. OpenStack still has challenges running it, but we run OpenStack. I'll come back to the storage system we run, et cetera. We try to use sort of cloud-based infrastructure, container-based infrastructure, and run it at scale. And one of the things that I'm going to talk about, which is relevant to NSF, is how do you do that? Because we know how research groups can run their infrastructure. We, by and large, don't have a good understanding. We know how research groups can run their infrastructure. We know how large-scale cloud providers, we observe how large-scale cloud providers run their infrastructure, but we really don't have a good understanding unless you work for a large-scale cloud provider. And the mid-scale in between, there's not enough investment in to understand how to do that, and that's where we operate. It's a tough place to be. But the Open Science Data Cloud had started out in 2010 with about a petabyte of data that we made available for people to compute over it. And as I said, we've run over 800 projects over the years, including a number with international partners through the NSF PIRE project. I told you a little bit about the MATSU collaboration. This is an example of what we did with NASA. We get all their data daily from their satellite EO1. We process that to make products. We process that in the MATSU cloud to make products available that they share. And then we run our own analytics. And one of the things we did is this was an idea that I like the terminology that Alex Selzay from Hopkins introduced. He called it the wheel. So these are what data scientists call scanning queries. We want to run an analytic, an algorithm, say an algorithm to detect a fire or flood over all the data. And if you just fire off queries like that to a large petabyte scale resource, it breaks. It just, you can't respond. So what this does is you constantly process all the data. The more hardware you have, the faster you could do it. It's like a Ferris wheel. And so each night we could process all the data, and then we batch the analytics together and we run them, and over a 24-hour period, that analytics goes over all the data. So whenever you get a new analytic, it goes over all the data, and we use that to sort of look for things like fires and floods, but also to introduce new analytics in there. We also look for anomalies in that data. So every once in a while, there'll be a volcano that goes off somewhere around the world, which puts a little spectral anomalies in the atmosphere. And on good days, we can see that. The satellite has to be over the volcano, and B, our algorithms have to work. Most of the time, if the satellite is over the volcano, then our algorithms work because volcanoes produce a very large-scale anomaly from what's normally there. And so we're interested in scaling that down in these kinds of things. Getting back to this technology and applying it to things where the sensors I described sort of really exploded around next-gen sequencing. And one of the ways I sometimes think of this is, you know, a large-scale discipline will spend sometimes $1 billion on an instrument. You know, in physics, we build sort of an instrument. You know, if it's a $10 billion instrument, more or less you spend that, you build one instrument and spend that over 10 years. Astronomers do the same thing. And we'll come back to why this is important. In biology, the instruments cost a few $100,000, so you have a lot of them, and they tend to reinvent themselves every 5 to 7 years. But starting a few years ago, that produced a large amount of data that had no that overwhelmed all ways to sort of analyze it. And so some of the first large-scale operational cloud infrastructure was designed for this. The problem with human genomic data is you need a lot of security and compliance around it. And so we put security and compliance around the Open Science Data Cloud to produce the BioNimbus Protected Data Cloud. And we also interoperated with the NIH systems, dbGaP, and ERA Commons. ERA Commons is their authentication system, and dbGaP is their authorization system. So we built a system that interoperates with NIH so we can check whether someone is authenticated the same way that you authenticate when you look for your grant at NIH. We authenticate with that system to check who you are. Once we know who you are, we then authorize with the NIH system, which says what data sets you're allowed to look at. Now, these are public data sets, so anyone's allowed to look at them, but they have consents, and you have to agree to follow how that data is, you know, how that data should be used by the data contributor agreement, and you have to sign a data use agreement saying that you'll respect the restrictions on that data. For example, it can't be put on the internet, et cetera. And so we built this system, one of the things that I like about this system is you can build applications over this API, and here's a sort of a, we took a sort of a petabyte scale data set called the Cancer Genome Atlas, and then we did principal components, we did some standard analysis, and we're visualizing the first three components of the principal components, and we're coloring these two types of cancer by their genomic strata through these principal components and some clustering we did. And the blue is adenocarcinoma, the gray is squamous cell carcinoma. There's a separating hyperplane that's fairly easy to see with the support vector machine, and they're colored by their diagnosis under histology. Under histology, these two things look fairly similar, but under genomic stratification through this principal components of this RNA-seq data, they look quite different, and then the green are the misdiagnosed. This is interesting because the Avastin is effective for one of these, but actually shortens the survival curve for the other. So having better diagnoses is an important problem in this space, and you can think of diagnoses as an app over the API for data held by this. And we're actually going to launch an app contest so that we can sort of build out applications like this by the community with cash prizes of who can have the most impact by looking at data like this. Recently, we spent about 2 years, and we partnered with the NCI National Cancer Institute, and we built a commons that if you're an NCI-funded researcher, and you are subject to the NIH policy of genomic data sharing, which basically applies to 100 or more genomes, or sometimes smaller numbers if the disease is rarer, we'll host your data and make it available in this NCI Genomic Data Commons, and we'll do a community computation over it. We'll take the community's best pipelines and run it over it. And in the same way we talked about the Matsu wheel, which is a reanalysis, you know, one of the things, once you have the data, you have the ability to constantly reanalyze it. It's just how you want to structure your core hours. And so one of the things we do as the community develops better algorithms, we will reanalyze all the data. This is a big scale computation. We just completed about a 12 million core hour computation where we took about 48,000 exomes and did a consistent analysis of them with the best community pipelines. Four pipelines we ran. And 6 months from now or a year from now, when the community develops better pipelines, and you know, we have a process run by the steering committee, we will reanalyze all that data as appropriate. This data is kept with sort of the NIH, emerging NIH infrastructure for citation of data and publication citation and linkage of the two. So as you add your data to this, it's a citable resource. You get credit for it. You can link it to publications. And right now, this is about a 5-petabyte infrastructure. It has 14,500 patients in it, but this is the full genomic data of those patients, so that's why it's close to five petabytes. Most importantly, if you don't have the original data and you get a new algorithm, you can't, in practice, with our current sort of understanding of how to do the pipelines and how to understand the biology, you can't reanalyze it all. So the reason this is big is because we want to support reanalysis. Yeah.
Does it matter if the pipelines are different? do you have the libraries to support everything? Or
well, we weren't asked. We were told to support everything. So this is not the most ideal way to run a large-scale infrastructure. So we will come back to that. These, moreover, not only do we have to support everything, but we have to support pipelines that were designed to be run onesies, twosies for a particular workstation, not to be run at scale. So one of my challenges is we have to fix that. This is not a way for a mature group of scientists to proceed, but that's the way the community is, and so that's something we'll come back to. That's one of our challenges. That's a great question. So June 6th, we were very happy that Vice President Biden came to came to the University of Chicago to launch this infrastructure. He cares a lot about data sharing, and so we showed him the infrastructure. I'll come back to it because it's sort of we took some lessons learned in networks and applied it into operating large-scale infrastructure. But we, it was good for us, good for the team to have him there, and we showed him we showed him the genomic data commons, and then he went down the street to McCormick Place where there was the American Society of Clinical Oncologists had a meeting, and he announced the genomic data commons opening at that meeting. I think I want to emphasize that one of the key capabilities we built is the ability to do large-scale reanalysis of petabyte-scale data. That's, I think, a fundamental challenge, how to do that, and I think it's sort of a challenge at NSF. Comes to, you know, I'll say this a couple times because I think it's important. You know, if this were linear algebra, we have things like LAPACK and a lot of things that we could use to be target, you know, to target to specific architectures and to run at scale. And people write libraries over LAPACK, et cetera. We don't do that in bioinformatics because in bioinformatics, we think it's better for every graduate student to put unsupported software out there that runs on a single workstation. So I see that as there's opportunity for improvement because, you know, the community has developed a certain amount of, and I should say here, NCI also has clouds, not only BioNimbus, but three so-called cloud pilots, and we're designed to interoperate with these large-scale clouds. And we're technology neutral in that right now we run on-premise. We're in the beginning to interoperate with Amazon, and over the next couple of months, we'll begin to interoperate with Google and Microsoft. So we're cloud agnostic. We're just out there for the compute. There are important trade-offs that I can't talk about here in how we do that. You know, I think the paradigm is changing. We've talked about this for years. We see ourselves as having built three applications, a data portal, which is sort of a next generation portal where we brought the data together, the sort of the raw data, the clinical, the genomic, molecular data, the genomic data, that is, and the clinical data. We brought it together and harmonized it, used common schemas, and then we built an application over that, a portal for access. We also built a data submission portal, the other thing we did, though, both of those portals are applications over our API, and I'm going to abstract out how we built that, but a lot of what we think is we're exposing this API for anyone who wants to build applications, and we did a proof of concept by building two applications. I should say this, I think, is the largest collection of harmonized genomic data in the world now. There may be some larger repositories, but what's unusual about this repository is most repositories take different genomic or molecular data analyzed by different pipelines, by different groups, brings it together, makes it available, and the dominant effect, you know, if you're in the business, when you pull that data down, is the batch effect from where the source of data was. And so it's a challenge. And so what we've done is brought the data together. There's still difficult issues with batch effects, but by doing a common analysis, we can reduce the impact of those batch effects. That process, that's sometimes called, not my word, data harmonization. So this is the largest harmonized collection in around 5 petabytes of data out there. Finally, we took the same stack. This is a common software stack, and we're just bringing out, we're one of NOAA's data partners. This is, again, the 501c3 Open Commons Consortium. The other partners are Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and IBM. Some of those have more resources than we do, but we sort of have fun sort of playing around with the NOAA data and making it available to the research community. We see our role as understanding what the requirements of the academic research community is, collecting those requirements, getting the data sets for those requirements, putting the services and applications that satisfy those requirements, and building a commons. So again, commons co-locate data, storage, compute with the commonly used services and applications. And so our role in this space is to understand the academic, the earth scientist requirements and build a commons around that, so we create a working group, and that's indeed how each of those commons work. And so here, the first data set coming out is NextRAD, which is one of the data sets around for storms and stuff like this. We're in the process of adding other data sets. And if you have a favorite data set in earth science that NOAA has, come talk to us. We're 20% more fun to work with than other alliance partners, and we will be happy to take your requirements and stack it into our list. And even more welcome if this is an unfunded project. If you have a little storage and compute, we have an architecture so you can interoperate with us. Come add your storage and compute so we can build a larger environmental commons for the community. So we, a week after Vice President Biden visited us, we were lucky enough to be invited to one of the White House Open Data Roundtables, this one for public-private partnerships, and this was because of our work on the NOAA partnership. And so these Open Data Roundtables were famous for their cupcakes. So I can't eat cupcakes because I'm a celiac, but I can take pictures of cupcakes. I think this is sort of an important graph for it. It's a little hard to understand. Let me just say what it says. It basically says that even though we only have a few hundred users, each of those users tend to use 20,000 to 200,000 core hours per month over the resident data. And so I think that's really important. For discovery at this scale, you really have to have the data available, but then you have to give sufficient core hours so they can compute over that. And I'm going to come back to this theme, but how we design these resources as cyber infrastructure is important. And even though, I haven't learned very much. As Chetan mentioned, I ran a company for, I guess 20 years. One of the things I learned, I'm a slow learner, one of the things I've learned running a company is good is up and to the right. And so this is a little counterintuitive because we only have a couple dozen people using over 200,000 core hours a month, but that's kind of interesting there. So even though it's not high and to the right, those are the things I want to call out, that this resource is sort of allocated by giving certain groups a fair amount of core hours to compute over the data. Now, this is tricky because just because we give you 100,000 core hours each month doesn't mean the best science will come out of you. So one of the things we're trying to understand is how to get better at predicting what science comes out and trying to allocate and optimize the number of publications and the quality of the publications. And, you can do silly things with lots of core hours over lots of data. You can do smart things with lots of core hours over lots of data. And, again, judgment is really important here to maximize the amount of science that comes out. And I think we need to get much better at that. Chetan also mentioned the PIRE. So for the last 5 to 6 years, we taught I think 70 students and early career scientists, where we gave them 6 to 8 weeks of sort of immersion in big data science projects using the Open Science Data Cloud. And we also sort of gave tutorials to 500 others. So, this is one of the sort of week-long workshops we ran in Amsterdam in 2014. So this is the strategy. It's a pretty simple strategy, but it's the strategy that we've been following sort of since 2010. The strategy is focus on the data, create an open source platform for the data, and then host a critical mass of data. So we lead with the data. We don't lead with the scientific problem. We lead with the data. So to encourage sort of a number of scientific problems by bringing together any researcher who has ideas over that data. Then sustainability is very, very tough in this space. So our emerging sustainability model is give away, we have a certain amount of allocations we could give away, we give those away. We then collaborate with sort of medium-sized projects to build discipline-specific commons for them, like NASA, like NOAA, like NCI, et cetera. And then what we're trying to do now is to interoperate and facilitate an ecosystem. And then if you want to compute at a scale we can support, we pass through that compute, and you could either use our cloud or one of the public clouds that peer with us, and we'll get back to that. And so because otherwise you have what's known as the tragedy of the commons. This came about, you know, this was a title of a paper by Hardik in Science a number of years ago. And this is an old concept where if the village has a commons and there's one cow by someone who doesn't care about the village, that cow can eat all the grass in the commons and all the other commons, cows go hungry. Now, scientists are even worse than cows, at least in our experience in the early years, that if you don't moderate the amount of compute, they'll arbitrage, and since, you know, at the end, we didn't charge for compute, they'll take all compute and destroy the commons for everyone else. So we basically allocate carefully and then allow them to compute at a broader scale using either our resource or another resource. And then we're trying to impose a small tax on a few of the applications that could pay to break even. We may or may not work this out in time. It's sort of a race now because the infrastructure is getting a little old and we're trying to refresh it. But this is our current strategy. This is there are a couple of diagrams I wrote for this for the report that was mentioned. This is one of them. This is a little complicated, but I think what's important is if you co-locate storage and compute, then you're in this sort of modality that's quite different than HPC. The modality is that data tends to be useful for not only the life of the project, but the life of a lot of other projects. So you have to sustain that data for a long time. And then you're not only supporting traditional analytics and traditional archive, you're supporting sort of integration and all sorts of other types of things. And so this is one way to understand how data-intensive computing is different than HPC. I'm going to quickly go through the technology stack. This is the technology stack that emerged after several years. We need a scalable storage system that will, you know, I think we're spinning 20-plus petabytes of disk now. We want an open-source scalable system that scales out that far and can be used for long-term storage of data. So we use an object-based storage system that's compatible with the S3, the Amazon S3 API. Then we bring... We sort of use cloud and container-based computing to pull data from the object-based storage system, and then we support, the ability to have the APIs for access and compute and analysis and query, and as well as a data portal for access, a data submission portal, and interoperability with sort of pay-as-you-go compute infrastructure. We run this over sort of, and this is, I think, underappreciated, so I'm going to say this a couple times. To make this work, you have to do infrastructure automation. Now, part of that is sort of understood now through DevOps, but you have to automate the provision. Basically, software has to be used to provision infrastructure at scale. So we have an underlying DevOps infrastructure But then on top of that, we put these long-running microservices like digital ID, metadata services, transport services, et cetera. And so this is the architecture that there are slight differences between the different clouds, but this is the architecture we try to make each of the commons compatible with. And then we summarize these. I've talked a little bit about this, and I'm running out of time, so let me move to some lessons we learned. I think the most important thing is we took the view that if I ask a data scientist what they want, I get a long list. And we don't have the resources to make a long list work. So we asked, what are the core common resources that would support a commons and allow us to satisfy the applications people want to build? It's a digital ID. It's a metadata service. It's long-term persistent storage. It's the ability to launch container-based and virtual machine-based computation, and it's high-performance transport, and then exposing that all through an API. And so other kinds of things that you might want, like provenance and other kinds of things, we can interoperate to support that, but our core commons don't support that. So what we've learned, I'm going to take a few lessons. One is I want you to think, microscopes and telescopes allow you to look at small and far things. Cray computers allowed us to sort of do simulation science. Each of these sciences were started with a factor of 10 to 100 improvement in performance. We think of what we've built, the commons we've built, as an instrument for data that supports discovery. So, you know, for several years, even though it was unpopular, we focused on how to build instruments that are commons to facilitate discovery. And so the first lesson is I actually think it's important, at the beginning of a science, you want to understand how to build instruments. I think it's important that we understand the basic foundations by which we build these instruments. And then the question is, what scale? So I think NSF sometimes uses the word mid-scale. We sometimes think of this as if you take a large data center and you divide it into smaller chunks, sometimes those are called pods. So these are 20 to 50 racks of compute. So we think of what we do, we call that a pod or a cyber pod, or sometimes mid-scale computing. We think that we have to build out data services, infrastructure automation services, digital ID services, metadata storage services at the scale of a pod. That is 20 to 50, maybe 10 to 50 racks plus of compute. And so that's the scale we need to do things. And then you could think of, for a long time we did everything without a database, and we did databases. You know, for the last few years we've rediscovered databases with NoSQL databases. I'm talking about one more scale up as we try to sort of scale core data services to sort of these pods, cyber pod-like infrastructure. So that's one of the core lessons that we've abstracted out. Another lesson we've abstracted out, and this came back to it, we're interested in taking a petabyte scale amount of data and constantly reanalyzing it. Software is not designed for that. You have to think out how you want to do this kind of computation. So, software development plus system automation, sometimes called DevOps, we sometimes use the word analytic ops for running large-scale analytics over these mid-scale computing infrastructure. This is just you could see sort of as we're running 10, this is part of our, we've done a number, 10 million, 12 million, million core hour computes in our infrastructure, and this is sort of just a visualization of that. But it's really, I think I've got a couple slides about this. It's a little hard to do this quickly, but the data that we get is quite variable. And so our pipeline should be able to process the data at a fixed number of gigabytes. You know, if I fix, say, a 64 gig machine with, 16 cores, I should be able to have a pipeline run reliably over the data, at 4 gigabytes per hour for that fixed size computing infrastructure. If that were the case, then for a fixed file size I'm processing data from a few gigabytes to almost a terabyte per file size. This should be sort of, there should be no horizontal spread. The horizontal spread represents the uncertainty and variance that comes from processing data with different quality, software with different quality, over systems with different quality, including stragglers, and I get at least an order of magnitude of variation in how long it takes to process data depending upon the quality of the software, the quality of the data, and the quality of the infrastructure I'm running over. And so controlling that variance, we call it the long tail of scientific workflows, is one of the things we're working on, because if we don't, we just can't do the computation at the scale we need to. This is the same chart, exactly the same chart, where I color by source of data. And so you see that a lot of this artifact is related to the data, not necessarily to how we process it. One of the ways I think of this is if I take E, which is the size of a single event, say in molecular data or in physics, that's a high-energy physics, or in astronomy, it's sort of an image, and then I look at P, the size of the capacity I'm doing, it's kind of, you could sort of break out the computations you do with this kind of infrastructure by how big is the event you're processing compared to the resource you're using. And then you have, you know, millions to billions to trillions of events, dozens to hundreds to thousands of computing infrastructure, and you get sort of, you get this sort of breakdown of the field. And biomedical informatics is kind of hard because the size of the event is more or less where we are with the size of a single machine, unlike physics where the machines are much bigger than the size of the events, so it makes it a little harder to compute. And the other thing that makes biomedical informatics, which is one of the reasons I'm sort of interested, is the software tends to be less mature because in other fields you have a single instrument you run for a decade, so you get the software right. In biomedical informatics, we reinvent our technology every 5 years, so the software is never good. That's not an ideal situation to be in if you have to process petabytes of data. The second lesson is I think we tend to focus a lot on the core infrastructure. How do I provision storage, virtual machines, containers? You know, that's not particularly interesting in an application programmer. What's much more interesting is these higher order services like the ones I showed you there. And finally, this is a diagram that didn't get into the NSF report that Jayton mentioned. I'm the sort of firm believer after being in this space for a while that the mid-range separates and you don't have what's sometimes called convergence, that you really want specialized infrastructure for big compute and specialized architecture for big data, and they're divergent, and the larger the scale, the more divergent. I think both are important in a portfolio. Understanding the science of both is important. Understanding the technology of both is important, and we need both. One of the things we did, this was another picture, in high-performance networking, a lot of cyber infrastructure was built by creating network operations centers, NOCs, and operating and having the NOCs enable large-scale high-performance networking for the computing, for the community. We did the same point of view. We built an operation centers for data commons. You can see it here. There's two, probably should be three or four more desks with lots of monitors where we monitor this, and we can monitor multiple data commons, and we do, and then we operate them for the research community. So a lot of what we try to do is how do you automate, what's the computer science and the computer engineering for automating these operation centers. So I'm going to just end here. A paper is coming out in the next couple of weeks. It's in archive where we abstract out the core principles of what we think is important in a data commons. I've mentioned permanent IDs. I've mentioned several of these things. What I haven't mentioned is peering. The internet got started by large-scale internet service providers agreeing to pass packets at no cost. We don't have that in data. So what we call in data peering is the ability, if I have 5 petabytes of data and someone else does, and there's someone over both of them, I want a researcher over one Commons or Cloud to be able to access data and any of the others at no cost with data peering. Now, if it were just a handful of universities, we could do this, but data is in public clouds. It's in lots of places. There are lots of paywalls out there. So one of the things we feel pretty passionate about is data peering. We also feel that this infrastructure is going to change and that portability, getting your data out and into another commons or cloud is absolutely essential. So that requires peering. So we want the ability, which you can use with digital IDs, metadata, transport, and peering, we want someone to say, I want to move my petabyte of data. I don't like, you know, the OCC anymore. I want to move it to another commons. We want that to move. And not, you know, if you use other services, they may not move, but we want these core services to support portability so scientists can move their data wherever they want. So we do environmental commons. We do general science commons. One of the reasons I chose biomedical commons to spend time on is I think the impact is pretty important, but I think the technology, which is, again, where I think NSF can handle, is hard. It's hard for those reasons I talked about. It's on the edge where open source software breaks. It's where you need to do things. And so, you know, we're trying to support 1 million genomes. That's about an exabyte of data. You know, every 3 to 4 years, we get an order of magnitude. Right now, our infrastructure works for 10 to 100,000 genomes, you know, 10 to 100 petabytes. And we're building out the next scale out of that. And I think that's a basic challenge, you know, and I listed sort of the sub challenges, the analytic ops, the infrastructure automation, a number of those. And sort of where I want to leave you is, you know, at least what we see over the next 10 years is, you know, we will be building, and we like to interoperate through peering and core services, other commons sort of at the 10 to 100, you know, 1,000 petabyte level. So I think I have some time for questions. This is the most fun I've ever had in LIDA's data science seminar, so I want to thank you very much for inviting me. But thank you very much.
We'll take one from here, and then we'll move to the WebEx community and then come back. Karen?
So one observation, one question. One is if you're going to take sort of the nature-nurture thing seriously, you probably want to start storing other data about the patients besides the genome. So maybe that the scaling isn't actually linear in the way that you're saying, right, that you'll start thinking about collecting, like, sensor data and biomedical data and other contexts that are around people. And so that might go. And that's just kind of the observation. The question's related, though, right, because you talked about allocating projects based on how good the science you thought might come out of it. Do you do similar thinking around either the data coming in or the people or organizations applying?
Yeah, so on the first, one of the reasons I focused on the environmental commons, we actually co-locate those. So we're one of the places where we can take large-scale environmental data and put them over large-scale health data. So that's a lot of what I was talking about. When I said that linear scale, I was just saying we've observed for us to get a tenfold increase in our ability to scale, it's going to take us 2 to 3 years of research and development. That's all I'm saying. And then, yes, we have to be thoughtful about what data we can support. That's the toughest decision we make, is what data we can bring in.
Operator?
Thank you. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question over the phone lines, please press star then one and record your first and last name clearly when prompted. Again, please press star then one if you have any questions at this time.
All right, so we'll return to live. So do we have any other questions?
Yeah.
Well, I was amazed if you're saying that, you know, you pretty much, number one, your premise is common services, et cetera, but on the other hand, you said you are supporting graduate students' programs. So there seems to be a little bit of a
programs are encouraged to use our common services, but the programs can do whatever they want.
But The question is, you mentioned one of the challenges, which is really the quality of the data, quality of the software, quality of whatever else, okay? How do you decide what is acceptable metadata? Because I think curation of the data is very important. And I was puzzled or amazed. You said, you know, first you kind of have the details, or you have the schema, what you would like to have, and then you gather details about project files, cases, and annotations. How compliant are people in this?
Well, I mean, I go back to one of the principles I've used for years is principle conservation of difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ever since I've known you, metadata has been a problem. So we have no opinions about metadata. Each community self-organizes and does what they do with regard to metadata in that community. And then all we do across communities where discovery is very important is support whatever that community does with a common meta. So the metadata is just a key value metadata, so the community could do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just support a common API to access that. But it's conservation of difficulty.
But then the interoperability among and between the commons, the peering that you have.
Well, I would simply encourage your NSF supported investigators to work harder.
Yes.
Because obviously they haven't made enough progress in this
painless
area.
Painless curation and didn't go very far.
Yes. I completely agree with you. Yeah.
How adaptable is this architecture to GPUs instead of mobile reports?
Well, this gets back to one of the things. So the architecture doesn't care. The pipelines obviously care.
Okay.
So one of the challenges I would really encourage, and you know, we talked a little bit about this, at least in the areas I care about, bioinformatics, environmental sciences, I would very, very much like a process, you know, driven by NSF PIs. To get a common set of primitives the same way we have for LAPAC. So the lack of primitives in bioinformatics is killing us. That means we have to do heroic efforts to take a pipeline that was never written to run over 50,000 genomes and make it run at scale in our infrastructure. We don't have the ability, except in limited cases, to retarget that to a different architecture. So with the changes in architecture, with the integration on the chip of GPU and other kinds of things with chips, this is critically important. It's sort of not in our plan right now to do that, but it is one of the things if I had a longer version of this talk, I'd propose five challenges for the computational community. One of them is to, if it's in bioinformatics, to create bioinformatics primitives so the primitive could be compiled out to a GPU or to other specialized architecture. We don't have that now. So all the things that we do in linear algebra, we can't do in this space.
But I wonder if that's because bioinformatics users are a lot. Because, for example, in Python, that's less of a problem. Right? There are standard compilations of LAPAC.
It's not the LAPAC. It's, for example, there's a notion of alignment. You know, we do certain things in variant calling and alignment. I'm talking about slightly higher order things.
Right. I'm saying, like, for example, the numerical libraries in Python, which is pretty high order language, are, by design, interoperable.
But they don't. We should come back to this. It's not at that level in Python I'm worried about.
Okay.
Because, you know, I mean, people give us Python, Perl, Java, and R in a pipeline tell us to run it at scale, where they take the same primitive operation and they're widely different implementations across those. We'll come back to that.
Well, Dr. Grossman, thank you so much. And please join me in thanking Dr. Grossman as well. That's really And you should be hearing from a new incoming fellow over the next few months as to who our next speakers will be. Thank you again.
Operator?
Yes, we do have a question online.
Oh,
do you want to stay and answer the question online?
I don't have to be anywhere until tomorrow.
Yeah, we can.
What's the question?
Our question comes from Jean Wong. Sir, your line is open.
Hello?
Yes.
This is Jean Wong from UMBC. My question is... This primary analysis needs to be done across multiple data commons. So without moving data together, how you think we could do it?
I think the question was, if I want to do discovery across multiple commons, how would I enable that? Is that the question?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, in genomics, so for this is a classical question, you know, where we have scatter gather and those types of things. There are restrictions in biomedical data where certain data can't leave certain countries. So we have an active prototype of a project like that where either because of policy or because of the cost of transport or because of convenience or others, where we scatter the query, you know, in a sense it could be scattered and then gather results. Obviously, you can't always do this, but this is sort of a classic problem in computation, and we're sort of supporting that when data parallelism is there. What we don't want is for different pipelines to be run in different places, but that is one of the core services we're trying to support across commons that peer. So that was a great question. Thank you.